Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, your weekly dose of Porsche culture. With Tech Talk, Heritage, the Ren Builds playlists, along with a massive dollop of waffle, we'll keep you entertained. So subscribe now on any podcast streaming service and YouTube. Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome back to another episode. This week, we're going to be talking to Level Motorsport Wiring. Now, I make no apologies for this. It's been a while since the Tech Talk episode came out, and this one is for the nerds. So, yeah, if you're looking for the casual chat, it possibly isn't for you. If you're looking to deep dive everything that makes a car work, especially in the modern era, this one is for you. I'm talking to a guy called Matt, and he, I kind of reached out to him a long time ago when I first started thinking about the Ren 550 and the things that I could and couldn't do. Part of that whole process has been to collect, differentiate between the suppliers and the people I can work with and the people that, you know, maybe there just isn't a fit. So that's what we're going to talk about later. Before we get into that, though, as you'd expect, there's some preamble to this episode. It's a long one as well, about an hour and a half. So yeah, belt up for this one. First thing I'm gonna talk about this weekend. So I am taking a bit of a break this weekend. I'm off to Victorious Festival in Southsea. So I'll be watching Queens of the Stone Age later today. This has been recorded on Friday. And then tomorrow, Kings of Leon over the weekend, all sorts of stuff. So it's gonna be really good for me to get out and kind of let my growing hair down. Also, you may, if you've been a bit of an OG with the podcast and the YouTube channel, way back in some of the earlier episodes, you would have seen a black dog kind of loitering around in the background. That guy's name was Bodie. He was my rescue collie. Sadly, he passed away about 18 months ago. My wife and I had three dogs, and then kind of lost Roxy, the oldest one, and then Bodie after that, and then earlier this year we lost the last one, all through old age. We left it 6 months, and now we have a new rescue. So if you ever see in episodes, because there's going to be quite a few coming out in the next sort of 3 or 4 months on YouTube, a white fluffy cloud walking around, that's Mochi. So I hope you give Mochi a warm welcome. If you hear anything in the background, that's him kind of shuffling around, doing his thing, settling in. So that's really cool. I'm also going to talk about the Ren Sporter. Now, I've mentioned this a couple of episodes back about the decision to kind of step away from buying a Lotus donor or a VX220 donor for the M550 and kind of looking at what I need to move further forward. And that has been a transporter, so a commercial vehicle that I can kind of then ferry parts around. If I don't want to use the Porsche or I'm working on the Cayman or anything like that, then I can jump in the transporter. It'll be all liveried up in a kind of Rothmans livery. That's going really well. Stockpiling parts. It's still got to look really cool. Here's the trick, right? It's got to look really cool, but on a budget, because what I don't want to do is then get into a whole build of a magazine show car for a transporter, which takes me again for thinking about the A to B thing I was talking about before, way further away from B. What I need to do is kind of lock in to kind of the finding the sweet spot between creating a really cool looking van, all branded up in the spirit of 962. That's the kind of Ren Sporter's theory. That's kind of the thing I'm going after, is a reference to the Group C Rothmans 962. So far I've got 19 inch Navis Schmoove wheels, which are steels. They look like banded steels, but they're not. They're deliberately and custom made for the transporter with the right offset. Wider at the back than the front, so they're a staggered setup. They come in silver originally. I bought them used for not a lot of money, in fairness, with terrible tyres. Thankfully, Michelin sorted me out with a set of Pilot Sport 5 acoustics, which is going to be fantastic on that van. And they've been painted with a kind of gunmetal rim and then a kind of creamy centre. Now, if you look at the 962, you'll see the kind of the, and it's through age, right? The kind of plastic aero disc that sits on the front of those wheels has aged and gone a kind of patinaed, creamy color, and that's what I kind of want to reference. But actually, the paint on a lot of those cars is still quite bright white. I was really lucky because I was at Boxing Gas the night before Megaphonics and got to see all of these cars up close. So I took a load of pictures around the detail of those cars that I'll bring into the transporter. A lot of this stuff, though, is going to be fairly simple to introduce without it being hugely costly. And that's kind of the point, right? Is trying to find that sweet spot of doing things so you stand back and go, wow, there's so many cool details in that van, but it not being a huge money drain. So Design Stuff Online, John, the guy that owns Design Stuff Online, I've talked about that guy for a lot of time. He's who I use for custom decal work, or so please reach out to him. I know he appreciates it when he gets a shout out. So we're going to do some work together, whether I travel to him and we kind of finish off the design. I've been mocking something up in Photoshop. So you'll see kind of Rothman stripes down the side. On the 962, there's a round door with a number on it. And then to the, I think it's to the rear of the car, you see the kind of Porsche logo, and then Rothman's underneath. Racing, I think, is underneath. And obviously, the Porsche brand is very protective of its logos, so I can't and wouldn't use tons of Porsche logos all over the vehicle. That's not going to work. Rothmans is a dead brand, right? So that it was a cigarette brand in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. No longer is it no longer exists. So while the logo and brand itself, there will be a holder or an owner of that. No one's chasing anybody over that. So I'm going to use some of the Rothmans livery elements, but I'm not going to be using a ton of Porsche stuff because the last thing I want is to like be you think I'm doing a really cool thing and end up with a cease and desist on my lap. So here's the problem though. So I do want the interior to be really cool still, even though it's a van. So I bought a set of Vauxhall Corsa or Opel Corsa VXR seats. Now they're Recaros and they look very, very much like the kind of wing back 3,000-4,000 pound each. The Recaros you can buy, I forget what they're called now. You can pick them up relatively cheaply. And I found a set that had a blue center off the blue edition VXR. And I've kind of had those. One of them, the airbag had popped on the side because they're seat airbags, which I don't need actually for the van. And there was some stitching that had come apart, but like generally the condition's really good. Now, it was never going to be worth me sending those seats off to my kind of like super pro level, really experienced and relatively expensive trimmer because again the van isn't deserving of that. That's not the intent with the van. So I have a local trimmer that I'm working with that is working to a price. So I don't expect the same quality that I would from Dave the trimmer, who's my friendly but exceptionally good trimmer. This is working to a budget. So I'm sure if you kind of take a really close look at some of the details, off I find flaws. I'm absolutely certain of that. But that's okay because I'm working to a budget. And what I want you to think about as well, and this will happen, I'll talk about this when the kind of build series of my Cayman goes live, and I kind of it's gonna hopefully gonna be a bit of an educational series about these sorts of things. One of the key points is, set your expectations based on the budget and the kind of money you're spending. So if you get mates rates for a paint job and it's, 1500 quid, and he's telling you he's gonna do a windows out paint job for 1500 quid, well, you know what you're gonna get. If you spend £15,000, and the guy's sending you shots all the way through, and he's kind of got, there's an Aston Martin in the background, and you're probably going to be okay. So the van is a tricky balance between getting it to look aesthetically really good, without throwing a ton of money at it. But it's still going to have these Recaros, and it's still going to look cool. And I bought a steering wheel from a Polo. That's a multifunction steering wheel that's got leather trim. That's with the trimmer as well. If you've seen the Rengineering Cayman, and if you buy 911 and Porsche World in about a week's time, you'll be able to see it in that. you'll see that some of the outer trims of that, where it's leather, is done in sort of reference to the GT2, the 901 GT2. So I've transferred that idea to the van as well. So it's going to be blue Alcantara around the outside, then the grey GT4 Alcantara at the kind of top, and then a red centre marker. Seats, as I mentioned, off the VXR blue edition, so the seat centres are kind of a blue with like a light blue stitch. They got the trimmer to match that stitch. So the gear gator is going to be GT4 grey with that sort of lighter blue stitch. The steering wheel is going to be, as I said, blue, sort of dark blue, that's kind of a Rothmans blue, with the grey, with the red, and then that lighter blue stitch. It sounds horrendous, but I got full faith, okay? The bit that I've stumbled across is I didn't realise until I bought those seats with the popped airbag and needing a replacement cover, like a plastic casing, so not the airbag, because that's not going back in, but just the casing, so it all looks nice. To buy one for the directly from Recaro that's not from a Vauxhall, those parts are like £50-60, so I just made the assumption that the plastic trim would also be about that for these. No, you can't even buy them from Recaro, you have to go via Vauxhall. Some parts are no longer available, which I kind of half expected, and the trims that I was going to use, which is, I thought it was quite clever, the inner trim to the seat. So if you think about the rear of this little plastic casing of the back of the seat, each side has a separate plastic trim. So I was going to use the inside ones on the outside, remove the airbag completely, and then you get a much more slender looking seat without this giant wart of an airbag sort of stuck on the side. Until I found out those trims alone, those plastic trims, and they're the size of your forearm, are £350 each. So these seats I bought for £300, you know, plus a little bit of labour and, you know, some time from the trimmer. And if I had to go and replace those trims, suddenly the whole thing is a bust. So I spent the last week looking for, believe it or not, another set of seats in not very good condition, purely to rescue those trims. And, you know, talking to the trimmer, and one of the things I absolutely love about my Cayman, and one of the things that really sets that car apart, I think, is the seat backs. And it gets mentioned constantly at shows and constantly, you know, it came up as a thing in both the magazine features that have happened in the last month or two. It was a really nice touch, and it was something that the green seat backs, so again, you know, go over to the Rengineering podcast or at rengineering.uk, you'll see loads of photos of the car. And you can see the green Alcantara on the seat backs. So I was thinking, oh, I wonder if I could do, rather than buy a whole new plastic trim, whether I could do something with the one that's broke. And if it's covered in Alcantara, which we weren't originally planning to do, then all good. It gets hidden. I get the cool look of the Alcantara, which I kind of like being a bit of a trademark or a statement from Rengineering Interiors. And then we started looking at how to do that. And again, it was just going to mean, you know, 3D scanning, 3D printing, you know, a big, massive ball ache, and it was going to take forever to do. And it just, again, it goes back to that thing of like, well, what are you trying to achieve here? Is it a full-on van show vehicle, or is it a commercial vehicle that looks cool? It's definitely the latter. So here's where we're at. I'm on the next few days after Victorious. I'm going to go and pick another set of seats up to rescue those trims purely, so it looks kind of complete, and I don't have a kind of the wart of the airbag, which is unnecessary. And you can't actually buy, or you can buy the parts, but they're such an expensive item anyway, it's not even feasible. What I'll then do is then resell those seats as for parts, and hopefully somebody else can, you know, I'll sell them obviously slightly cheaper than I bought them for. And then someone else can rescue some parts, and hopefully those seats will get cycled around a load of people that need different bits for their seats. What a palaver though. So then I thought, after all of that, I think I still really love the idea of doing the seat backs in a dark blue Alcantara. So, you know, scope creep's kicked in, and that is probably still going to happen, but... And the passenger seat will be on a swivel as well, so you can spin it round. The van's a combi, so that means it's got back seats. What that allows me to do, and what the kind of the plan was for that vehicle, apart from being a usable commercial vehicle, is I could turn up somewhere with it all soundproofed. And if it's raining and I'm at an event, or I turn up to a venue that doesn't have a particularly good place to shoot a podcast episode, we can hop in the van. I can do it all in the van. So there's that as well. So that's happening in the next week or so. I'm really excited to start sharing some pictures of that. The van's going to be really low as well, so it's going to be on so low Bilstein suspension, which is pretty low. But yeah, sit tight for that one. And as soon as I've kind of got into the build, rather than collecting parts and figuring it all out, and there will be a build series on the, or at least a build episode that goes on YouTube for that as well. So, and then once it's all done and finished, you'll see me at events quite frequently in that thing. And hopefully next year, once we've got a chassis for the REM 550 and that's being publicized a little bit more, then, you know, we'll have the Rengineering Cayman, possibly a customer's car, the van, and then the REM 550 chassis for people to look around and kind of ask questions about as well. So I'm hoping next year that it will be kind of a bit of a leap forward again. But so that's the REN Sporter, and that's kind of what's going on at the moment with that. Yeah, Monday I will be at the Legends Drivers Club Sonderwinch event at Goodwood. So if you're free, I'm not sure if tickets are sold out for that actually. I think they might have done already. As again, I talk about Legends and Rengineering being partners, so I will always give Legends Drivers Club events a good rep. But yeah, I think that attendance for that might be absolutely sold out. If you have a ticket and I'm there, and which I will be, and you see me, feel free to come over and have a chat. I may well bring the mic and see if we can get some a bit of a walk around and some bits and pieces from that as well for next week's episode as a bit of an intro. We'll see. But if I'm there, if you're there, then come over and say hello. It'd be lovely to meet you. The last thing I'm going to talk about, which is a bit of a biggie, the boxing. So over the years, there's been a couple of episodes that you may well have listened to from Frank Cassidy and I. The first one was my kind of discussion about his life and how he got started, his origin story, that's how it's termed on the YouTube channel. And then the last one that came out was probably about 6 months ago. And that was about road trips and kind of, you know, the do's and don'ts and, you know, our advice from, well, Frank's more than mine, but yeah, our advice on, you know, how to make the best of those road trips. Thankfully, that friendship's kind of bloomed over the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, to the point where we get on so well that Frank, after, I think it was 2 days after Megaphonics, had shot off on holiday, rightly so, with Annabelle, the lovely Tats. And gave me a phone call and said, you know, I'm thinking about the Niners live event that's coming up in September. And I wonder if you'd be willing, this is Saturday's 20th of September, by the way, whether you'd be willing to co-host it with me. So if you are going to Boxing Gas Niners live on Saturday, the 20th of September, again, sadly, tickets are sold out for the live audience submission for that. So you, unless you've got one already, you're not going to be able to make that. But yeah, so you're more than welcome to kind of come to the event. I think there are drivers and passengers admission tickets, but the actual the live audience part of that is sold out. But I think the event you can still attend. Yeah, so it'll be co-hosted by myself and Frank and Annabelle. So if you are free and available, and you've got the ticket available, then yeah, come and see us. And it's going to be a strange one because it's the first time where I will have done something for the Boxing Gas brand, as opposed to as a part of Rengineering and shooting for Rengineering with featuring Frank. It's kind of the opposite way around. But it's a huge endorsement. Frank's rightly so very protective of the Boxing Gas brand, and you know, everything's highly curated, as you guys will know. So I take it as a huge compliment that he's willing to have me on there as well and host. So yeah, I'll see you on the 20th of September as well for that. So that's probably all the news, especially seeing as though it's only been a week since the last one. So yeah, but let's get back to the episode itself then. So yeah, it is a mega deep dive into wiring. There are some acronyms, and I'm conscious of this in my day job as well because I work in aviation. It's acronyms all over the place. Yeah, unless you know what those acronyms mean, it just sounds like a load of garbage to you. So I'll give you a heads up. ECU, engine control unit. PDM, power distribution module. Those things get mentioned quite a lot. Engine control unit is the brain of the car. So the engine, everything that's happening with the engine, the firing order, the ignition timing, the fueling. If you've got boost, the boost control, you know, not so control of the boost because that's done through the actuator, but and a boost control module, but the actual, it telling it that it's got, you know, sort of forced induction, all of that stuff happens in the engine control unit. Power distribution module, that power distribution module effectively is the how did you say this? Like the heart effectively of the wiring itself. So whereas in the old days you'd have a fuse board or a fuse box and you'd have kind of relay switching things on and off, this is all done signals coming through that power distribution module that tells the it sort of separates out and allows the right amount of amperage to go to volts to go to that particular module, that's the sub module effectively. So you know, if we take Porsche for example, PASM, the Porsche Adaptive Suspension Management, that will have an amount of power sent to it, or and then you know, transmission lines that go back to you know, another part of the car that says to switch from PASM Sport to normal, those sorts of things. All that's done through an intelligent module, as opposed to you know, blindly sending you know, a set amount of power and a relay or something that switches, or a switch that switches it over from one to the other. So it's just a much more intelligent way with far less to go wrong, and much more modern technology as well. So so throughout this next conversation, you will hear a lot of those sort of kind of quite in-depth techie things. And there's a couple of points where we stop and explain stuff, but like CAN bus and what CAN is. So if you want to, if this is a highly educational one, if you want to learn about all of that stuff, about how your car's wired up, and for me as a customer for Level Motorsport wiring for the REM 550, there's a lot of that kind of stuff in there as well. So if it's absolutely up your street and you're like, oh yeah, I can't wait to get into the detail of them, you know, how all this stuff works, sit tight, buckle in, get your coffee ready, or if you're driving, turn it up a little bit and overcome the road noise. If it's not, if you're kind of like, nah, I like the heritage stuff and I like listening to personal stories and, you know, what's going on in someone's life and how they got to where they are, then maybe skip this one and come back to, you know, one of the other 65 episodes that are out at the moment. I will obviously catch you back up at the end, and I really hope you enjoy this. There will be other tech talks coming out. Yeah, and I'll speak to you back at the end. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. And we are, I say we, I'm with Matt from Level Motorsport Wiring. I'm very lucky to be here. I didn't know what was going to be here. And then we got Phil Morrison's E30 M3 and a ridiculous 1400 brake horsepower 911 next to me, Turbo S 991.2 generation, I think it is.
Yeah.
Really cool. So we're here today. There's a couple of things that we want to get to. One is learn about Matt and the company itself and how it all started. And then I want to understand about the REN 550 build and as a customer, how that would be approached. Because as I've said before, I said this on the podcast actually, but the difference in time between the podcast going out and this going out months anyway, so no one will remember. But I spoke about the fact that my background is in the Royal Air Force. As a radar engineer and a communications engineer for years and years and years. So I'm happy working on wiring. There's a big difference between wiring a 1960s radar up and doing something that's kind of to a motorsport standard. And we've already off camera talked about what happens when many hands are in the pie over a prolonged period of time. And actually, sometimes the best thing to do is start from scratch. So welcome, Matt. Thank you and welcome to the channel.
No. Nice to be here.
Nice to meet you too. If what I always do with these is start with you.
Yeah.
So most of the people that have been on the channel so far are from a Porsche background, but again, off camera, your background isn't Porsche, but
no.
So let's wind the clock right back. What was your, did cars come first or did kind of engineering and kind of electronics, where did this kind of stuff start from? Is it, well, what's your background?
It's sort of, I've always been into cars because my dad's been a mechanic since he was like my age.
Yeah.
And he still owns a garage now. And so I worked for him since I was like 16 and did my apprenticeship through him. And then eventually moved on into doing more like fault finding and diagnostics, right, and then electronics, because I found that more interesting than like actual hands-on mechanical work. Yeah. For whatever reason, but it just appealed to me more. So then I focused more on that. Did a bunch of like, because in the normal automotive world, there's not much resources once you leave college for learning, other than some like privateer courses that people put on.
Right.
So I went off and did some like diagnostics and fault finding courses.
How were they?
They're okay. Like, the automotive world's a bit weird because nothing's really, unless you're a main dealer, none of the information is really out there. So you've got to sort of work from a blind standpoint of, there is some information available, but it's very basic and lacking compared to what you would get if you were a main dealer. And to be fair, main dealers don't get much information these days. The manufacturers tend to hide a lot.
Is this, we'll get on to the kind of really technical stuff, but are we talking about just the wiring diagrams or decoding CAN bus or?
Essentially anything like that. So a lot of the times you can't get access to wiring diagrams, or if you can, the wiring diagrams are half.
They're not
so
pin out then, level or
well,
something.
They are. They sort of are. You get like a diagram and you get like what pin does what to where.
Yeah.
But what they'll hide a lot of information.
Right.
So they'll be like, one pin will go to the other pin, but there's also a splice, but they won't tell you where that splice goes and stuff like that.
Right,
sort of you're going in half blind and you've got to try and work out how everything works, then find the fault and then rectify the fault.
Right. So just going back, because I don't want to get too far into the techie stuff yet. We will get there. Going back to your, so you'd spent some time with your dad, done your apprenticeship. You're like, I like it, but I can see where my specialism is going to be.
Yeah.
How did that go from that to you being like qualified enough to go, I'm going to branch out and do my own thing?
It's sort of, there wasn't really a stepping stone. Like, it wasn't really any sort of like,
just
pathway.
Went for it,
I just I liked electronics and I liked sort of doing wiring. Yeah. And I was doing a lot of wiring repairs.
Right, okay.
As a, doing the, like the diagnostics and whatever.
Yeah.
But it was sort of, so at the time I had my own project car, which was a Honda Civic.
Right.
And I
EP3 or
as a, at the time it was an EJ9, so
yeah,
like
the
69 to like 2000s year.
Yeah.
And I was had that as a track car, and I at the time was planning on rewiring it, so I jumped in like sort of head first and just did my best sort of
how
to get it
go?
Working. It was okay. Like it was obviously it's not anything like I do now.
No, of course not. No.
But it was sort of
Way you were in your kind of development.
So I needed that. I needed to jump in and just have that step to learn and get the basics and figure out what.
Is that because you were running an Emerald or something like a different ECU?
It was just a case of
cut a load of the shit out to make it.
Yeah, it was just curiosity, really. I just
right.
It's never with me. It's never really been that thing of I've got something and I've got to try and figure out how to make it work. It's sort of I just jump in and sort of have a go and then hopefully
jump
it all
in
works
and have
out.
A go. So another episode that I did with a guy called Jeff from Home Built by Jeff.
Right.
He's building an Alpha kind of 105 with a Ferrari 360 engine in the front.
Right. I think I've seen it.
Yeah. It's literally, and he did a 911 from a couple of years back as well. And he's a king of that, right? He just digs in and gets on with it.
Well,
so
that's been the common theme throughout my entire, like since starting this up. It's like even the business is like, I had a bit of financial support, but like I just literally just bought some equipment and jumped in and started doing it. It wasn't sort of like I had to be any, I had any qualifications or like I had any right to be doing it. It was sort of just, I just wanted to do it. So I did it. So
amazing.
And it
how do you, cause the bit that's difficult then is the quality has to be right.
Yeah.
You can't like, I mean, there's lots of things you can probably argue, you know, if it's cosmetic, you can arguably get away with something that's not quite right, but does the job.
Yeah.
Rally cars, there's a rally car just out of shot. And actually that, I'm sure that the panel gaps are going to be a bit whiffy in places, but you know what? It's there. The purpose is to rally and to be fast, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't need to look pretty.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got other stuff that like wiring, there's no real margin for error. You know, you've got to nail it pretty much.
You sort of say that, but then like you look at the wide spectrum of what people are doing out there at the minute.
Mm.
There's like a whole range of bad stuff, and there's, and there's not there's a gap between the bad and the good, and like nobody seems to fill that gap with like quality. So I sort of where I sort of saw the gap, and was like,
you're gonna slice in there,
yeah. Because it's like you either get club level, where it's like you just do a normal automotive wire job, and it's good to go, and it probably will be good, and it'll last. Or you get the really high end of like Formula One style wiring or WRC or something like that. There's nothing really in the middle. There's a couple people do it, but I don't want to say they do a bad job, but
of course not.
It's not as high of a quality as you'd want if you're going to pay that money for it.
Right.
So it's sort of, I saw a gap and I was like, okay, let's give it a shot.
Dude, honestly, to lots of people talk about this stuff and underestimate, and I think you're even, it sounds like you're playing it down a little bit. It's quite a risk, right? You've got to pay bills, eat, yeah, support a family, or if you've got a family, you know, and then to make a decision to go, you know what, I believe in myself enough to go and do it, and B, you know, unless you've been trained, or like you said, there's an element of financial support, but not kind of like, here's 2 million quid, go and build yourself a unit and crack on, son.
Yeah.
It's like, you've got to, there's an element of, you've really got to go for it, you know?
I've called it sort of like blind naivety. Like, you just sort of, you don't really know any better, so you just sort of have a go and see where you end up, sort of thing. And then as you get, so I'm like, I'm 3 years into this now, and I look back and I'm like, that was so absolutely stupid. Like, I would never do that now.
Right.
But then I had to do that to get to this point. Yeah. So it's sort of,
It's, I know you're being trusted with people that have got, you know, they're right. You know, Phil Morrison's eye for detail is pretty impeccable, you know, like his cars are rad.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, to be trusted with people's pride and joy in, you know, quite expensive vehicles that have a lot of development time in. You've obviously reached a standard where people are kind of identifying you with quality and kind of cost effectiveness, but really good quality.
I like to think so. It's like, I have this really bad problem where everything I turn out, I don't actually like. So it's sort of, I'll get to the end of the project and it's done and it's on the car and it's done. Yeah, and then I'm like, I could have done that so much better. I could have done this better. I could have done that better. And I was like, it's sort of that.
I guess
thing
that's the thing about being 3 years in and not 30 years in, right? Yeah. Is by that, the 30 year point, you probably don't want to do it anymore anyway. But I guess you've processed a lot of that, come out the other side of it and kind of gone, right, well, I know how to do that intrinsically. I don't need to think about it too much. But I think it's amazing, mate. And from what I've seen, the unit's really cool. It's in a really decent location as well. You haven't got to go too far off the beaten track to get here.
No, we're about 5 minutes off the motorway.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been to lots of places where it's not 5 minutes off the motorway. It's like, oh, I'm not too far, mate. And then you get there and it's like an hour off the motorway down four farm tracks. And, you know.
Well, funny enough, so this was my dad's original mechanics garage.
Is this where you did your apprenticeship then?
So, pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
So my dad then has gone to the other side of the petrol station.
Right.
So just over there.
Right.
And he had this as like a storage unit, and it was never getting used. So then when I decided, I don't work for him anymore, I have my own setup. So when we decided to do that, I took over the lease.
Right.
And then obviously, otherwise I would never have got this place, and it would never have fallen into my lap, sort of, so to speak. So,
and you've been here the whole time?
Yeah, so I've pretty much worked in this building since I was like 16.
Wow, you must feel at home though.
Pretty much, yeah.
Like sofa bed in the back corner, you're just like, I'm not going to go in tonight, I'll just stay here. It's fine, whatever. Has there been some late nights? And
I think the latest I've been here is probably about 11-ish.
That's not too
bad. Yeah, it's not too bad. I'm not organised, but I'm not disorganised, where things get left to the last minute sort of all the time.
Yeah.
So I try to have some balance somewhere.
Yeah.
My girlfriend probably begged to differ, but
yeah.
I do go home at like 5-6 o'clock, so I don't.
That's good.
I'm not here all the time.
He won't mind me saying this, but Dan, a good friend of mine, Dan from HPE Automotive, who builds, I guess you'd say Singer level Lotus Elise.
I think I've seen stuff. Him, yeah.
And they're all quick K20. All of his stuff is K20, and he works with Clockwise to kind of develop a lot
of
work.
Yeah, I've talked to him a few times.
Right, rad guy, has absolutely terrible boundaries in terms of working. You know, he will. Yeah, I don't know what time it is when you're watching this. Dan will be working on a Lotus at this point in time somewhere, and he's a really good friend of mine, so I can rip him a little bit for it. But to own your own business and find the boundary of, you know, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to make sure customers got the priority, they know they're going to get looked after, but actually, still going to switch off, go home, you know, enjoy a personal life and stuff.
Like, I come in at 7 and I leave generally at like 5:30, 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
So it's like, as long as everything gets done in that period, I'm happy.
Yeah.
And like, if things don't get done in the day because there's been a load of problems, then I'll stay. But generally it's like, I'll try to go home and have a life, I guess. But
yeah. I think it's, again, I don't know how much by design it was or how just you're Welsh, you live in Wales and actually you've got that catchment, but how much of your stuff is rallying? Because this is like the home of British rallying, pretty much.
Not much, funny enough.
Really?
I've only had like maybe 3 or 4 customers with actual rally cars. There's there's quite a lot of like normal motorsport in this area that
really?
I have
right.
as local customers. Like one of
Landau's around here, isn't it? Or
yeah, yeah. Landau and Pembrey is yeah. in the other side of Swansea.
Yeah.
One of our main local customers is Owen's Fabrication.
Yep.
So he does a lot of the Mini Miglia races, yeah, race yeah. cars, and we generally do a lot of his work. So he brings them here, and we then sort them out.
Mm.
But other than as companies, there's a few that we've talked to, but we haven't got a relationship
yeah.
with. It's generally
yeah.
just independent people building their cars.
Right.
But 90% of our business is further abroad, like further away.
Is it?
Like I
don't see the car.
No, they always bring the car here generally, fine. But because there's a element that I need to be with the car for a fairly decent period of time to be able to design the harness. But a lot of the time, a lot of our customers have been as far as like Scotland and stuff.
Right.
There's actually a guy from Scotland dropping a car off on Monday.
Is that really?
Yeah.
Trailing it down, just like a long ass weekend of getting it down.
Yeah. He said, I think he said he's leaving at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday.
Wow. Brutal. I hope you've had a lot of coffee, whoever you are that's dropping your car off. So is there a favourite build so far in the 3 years of operating? Is there something that you've turned out that you're like, I know you said that you're pretty critical of your own work, and actually, a high five to that, because I'm awful at that. I'm a real perfectionist, but there must be something out of that time that you've gone, I nailed that.
It's a bit of a weird thing, I guess, if you were looking at it from the outside, because I guess you could say I'm sort of a car person, but I don't actually like working on cars, and I don't like actually doing much with cars other than the actual wiring.
Yeah, yeah.
So like I don't actually get too involved, but I've been working with a bike company called Thor 100.
Okay.
And they've actually, it's quite refreshing to do something completely different and completely new, even though bikes, they're a little bit similar, but they're a completely different genre, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And so sort of everything I've done with them have sort of been the top of my favorite list, just because it's completely different to all the cars that I'm doing.
Amazing. So what's, have you got, is it more of the organic stuff, or have you got a plan for the kind of next few years? Is it just like, get better every time I do something, keep doing a great job? And
I guess that's the main objective, but the long-term, like 5 or 10 year plan is to be sort of up there with some of the bigger names, and to be doing some of the higher end sort of actual motorsport work, so like working in Formula One or WRC or working with factories or anything like that.
From my discussions and conversations so far, and the fact that I won't share who it is, but because I don't want to give away who it is, but I know 2 or 3 people that work in Formula One now. From a purchasing and sourcing position, without any knowledge, you would think that everything's in house, everything's like top of its game, kind of, and actually that's not necessarily true. Still outsource a ton.
It's surprising.
And some of that ton is to one man bands, you know?
It's surprising how, like, I've had a few conversations with a few different Formula One teams and other race teams, so like the LMP and GT3s and stuff like that. I won't obviously name them, but generally, they one team in particular, they only have a small subsection in house, so they have a couple of engineers and they'll only do critical repairs or time sensitive stuff, I would guess, and then everything else is shipped out, so all their main car stuff, all their like I guess you'd call like the main structure of the harnesses and stuff, they're all shipped out to one of the largest companies in the UK.
Right.
I don't know if you want me to name.
I don't think it's a problem.
I think most Formula One teams generally, their base, I can't think of the word, what you'd call it, but like their main car stuff is all done by Renvail.
Right. Okay.
And then everything else, so like sub assemblies and sub harnesses and stuff like that, will then be shipped out around everywhere else, whether they do it in house or whether they ship out to smaller companies. Like you've got HCI is a slightly smaller company than Renvail. They do a lot of stuff. Or like you said, they ship it then around to all the one man bands and stuff. What I funnily enough, what I found is that the Formula One companies, I'll go to the one of the bigger companies, and then the bigger companies will
outsource it again.
Sub it out. The smaller companies,
They probably, I mean, I don't know whether they must do, because their reputation's on the line, but they must get whatever work they've had done by somebody else in and then do an inspection to make you test it all out.
Yeah, from my talks with them and my experience, that generally they will outsource it to like me, and then I'll send it to them. They'll QC it.
Of course.
And then if it's good, they'll then send it off to the customer.
Yeah.
So obviously, because they want to protect their...
Of course. Because imagine the damage reputationally. They would never get work from the whole, probably the whole industry again, because I'm sure it's quite a close community, right?
So. Yeah. Oh, it's the wiring side of it, in especially, I think, is it like Milton Keynes or like that area where all the Formula One teams are?
Yeah.
And like the wiring, because there's not many people that do it, and there's only a few companies... All the people are always chopping and changing between those companies.
Of course they are.
And it's such a small knit community. To get into it from an outsider, like I haven't been through any of the motorsport courses, I haven't been through any of that structure, and I don't know anybody. So to get into that from the outside is really difficult. And like I've somehow managed to like weasel my way into some contacts and like figure out who the people are.
Probably
and, like,
through good quality work, mate. Yeah. You know, I know you played, again, you downplayed it, and you know, I had a conversation with somebody yesterday about the fact I'd worked really hard on something and it didn't go as I planned it to. But the feedback's been like, chill, don't, you know, it's fine, it's okay, you know. And actually what your kind of level of okay is, for most people, it's like their best work.
Well, I must have really high standards for myself, because everything I turn out, I don't like or it's really bad. So,
And again, even with customers, right, it doesn't take much, you know, you do some work, it's pretty shocking, it gets out there, your name gets attached to something that's pretty shocking, the internet speaks, someone gets missiled, and then that's it, game over, or, you know, really impacts you, right? So I guess when you turn stuff out, there's always that in the niggle in the back of your head, it's like, it's got to be good, because otherwise I'm not going to get any more work
on this. I'm always thinking of the bad, how it's going to go bad, rather than how it could be good, rather than, So it's not, I never, well, to be honest, like generally all my customers have been pretty happy, I guess, and I haven't had any bad feedback.
Not that you've known about anyway.
Yeah, not that I know about. And so generally all my customers are pretty happy and satisfied. So I guess I must be doing a good job somewhere, I guess.
I'm sure you are. So taking it to the nerdy stuff then, incoming, we're getting to the nerdy stuff now. Standard factory wiring, motorsport wiring.
Yeah.
Right. So again, treat me like an idiot. I'm an idiot. Talk to me about the kind of the fundamental differences between something that is kind of on that Porsche, or I mean, it's probably, I don't know how much of a difference there is in quality between low end and high end stuff, but what is the difference? Because in my head, I'm thinking like the rally cars and things like that, that are motorsport, so much more MVH, you know, like vibration is probably the biggest, so it needs to be vibration resistant. That you wouldn't necessarily get on a road car. So am I thereabouts, or is what makes
sort
the difference?
Sort of. The biggest difference between like an automotive, just a general bog manufacturer standard. And bog standard automotive wiring harness, and like a motorsport grade harness, is generally cost. Like they're doing production stuff, so they want to bang it out. They want to bang out hundreds a month at the lowest cost possible.
Yeah.
So they're always done to be quick and efficient and cheap. Whereas sort of like our motorsport wiring harness is done to a higher standard with a lot of labor.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, the cost is like sort of the last thing you're looking at. It's sort of, you're looking at the quality, you're looking at whether it's sealed, you're looking at how each wire is like strain relieved, or where each wire runs, whether it's next to something or that it shouldn't be, or
so you're talking about the difference between power and signal wires and things like that.
You have noise in electrical systems, and then generally you'll want, so anything that's like a low voltage and you have like a low voltage range to read from, you generally don't want any noise on that, because you could be picking up the wrong signal because of the noise generated. So you have to sort of work out when you're doing the design, you've got to sort of work out what could be susceptible to noise, and then sort of what would be the thing causing the noise, and then sort of either separate them or find a way to either put them together. But then
shield or something.
Shield it, yeah. Or so like with concentric twisting, you can have different layers. So like in the center layer, you would have like all your shielded cables. And then on the next layer, you could have all like the smaller gauge wire for like any signals.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the outer layer, you could have all your power wires. Right. So because they, because each layer is then crossed,
yeah,
you can then, yeah, because each layer is crossed, you can sort of, it sort of doesn't remove noise, but it sort of protects each other against the noise.
Sure.
So like if you had power wires running across some signal wires underneath, if they were crossed, because they're crossed against each other, they sort of aren't so susceptible to the noise.
Yeah. As if they were running parallel.
Yeah, if they're running parallel, then it's a problem.
You're going to induce a load of noise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why you have like, there's also, you can, there's also other things you can do. So like if you have a, so like direct injection on like some of the modern stuff, the injectors are really high frequency and high voltage. So they create a lot of noise into the system.
Right, yeah.
So if you're running them next to anything that's like a signal wire, you're going to end up with noise on that.
Right.
So what you do with the direct injector wires is you twist them in pairs for each injector.
Right.
And then because the way, so the way you twist it, then the noise sort of cancels each other out in the twist.
Yeah.
So then you don't get as much noise radiated outside of the, I can't remember what you call it, outside of the bundle of the twist, sort of twisted pair.
Yeah.
So then that doesn't generate as much noise into the harness, and then you can, it's just different ways to sort of mitigate noise and protect from it or prevent it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of like connectors and stuff then, because you touched on it briefly, things like weather protection, that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Like, what, again, from a layman's perspective, when I have seen motorsport wiring, they're like big multi-plugs with, you know, and you don't typically get those. You get like bog standard push fit stuff on.
So a lot of automotive stuff is generally inside the car, so you don't need the weather protection. Whereas from in a motorsport environment, generally the entire car is either exposed to some level of dirt, moisture, because you'll find most race cars aren't fully sealed from the outside.
Yeah.
The insides generally get just as dirty as the outsides most of the time. So generally, as a standard, you'll want to try and seal the entire harness to prevent any outside moisture, dirt, debris, anything getting inside and potentially damaging or corroding any of the wire inside.
Right.
Or the terminals or anything like that.
Mm.
So what you'll find is 99% of the time you'll try to use either connectors, if it's an OEM application, so like you have like an injector where you have a specific plug you have to use.
Yeah.
You'll have to find a sealed version of it, so with one with the like the weather seal in it, and you'll have to make sure that the wire is then able to be sealed with that seal.
Right.
So a lot of the time, our wire that we use is smaller than most automotive wire.
Okay.
So you'll find that the seals don't actually seal against the wire. Right. So you have to do a certain amount of things to then make it seal.
Yeah.
So you can even put a tiny bit of heat shrink on the wire if it's a smaller wire, or you can use a bigger wire. It just depending on what you're trying to do. Or then if you're going to go with the full hog, and if the connector is able to, and it's got like any way of like, you can put a boot on it, completely Raychem molded boot, which then you seal that against the harness and the whole thing becomes a sealed unit.
So going back to the customer experience then, because I want to get to me as a customer or engineering as a customer effectively. And just in case you haven't followed so far, you haven't, go and subscribe because it'd be great for the channel, but also Rengineering is going to build a 550 Spider carbon fiber body on a 111 chassis, so that's a Lee Exige with an air-cooled engine, right? So none of that stuff's supposed to fit together, which is part of the reason why it's called Rengineering, because it's a mix of re-engineering and Rensport from Porsche. But conscious that as none of those things are supposed to fit together, me coming in as a customer will then need to talk to yourself about, where do I start, dude, with that? Because an air-cooled engine is not supposed to be in a Lotus, and a Lotus has got, you know, wiring harness for the car, but that ain't going to work. So I'm a customer, I come in and go, where do we start, dude? Talk to me. Talk me through it.
Generally, your main starting point is you need to figure out what electronics you're using. So what ECU you're using, whether you're going to use a PDM or whether you're going to try and keep a traditional relay and fuse setup.
Yeah.
And then, so we need to work through that and figure out who is also going to be doing that setup.
Yeah.
So then we can obviously then work with them to get everything in the right place, make sure everything is going to get wired properly and put like sort of, so it all works at the end of the end of it. It's sort of, you have to sort of think 15 steps ahead to sort of make a start sort of thing. So once we've got all that sorted and we know what we're using, we can then start talking about, like, so we need to start looking at like the harness design, what ways we're going to do things, what requirements we've got and what application we're trying to meet, I guess.
At what point would you get involved though? Would you get involved
ideally
early, really early on, or kind of build? Or
90% of the time, the customers have mostly already got their cars built, and that's they then thinking, come to me at the end.
And you're like, great, I've got to pick that now. Fantastic.
Yeah, so a lot of the time, I'd rather be involved from the beginning so that everybody can be happy and on the same page throughout the entire build, and there's no problems then later on.
Yeah.
But 90% of the time, customers end up coming to me.
We're on blank sheet of paper. Yeah. We're kind of like, I know what the building blocks and how they're going to fit together, but that's it. So
Yeah. So generally, we'd have to work out what electronics we use.
Yeah.
And then the next step would then be, once we know what we're using, we'll then have to do all the like IO assignments and figure out how things are actually going to work, whether they'll work the way we want it to, or whether, like, so if you do go a PDM route, you're going to have to make sure that so all your functions are actually going to function the way you want them to. So how you switch them in, and then the logic you're using, and then how you, like, then obviously how you wire them out. So because there's this, obviously, let's say a wiper motor, for example.
Yeah.
You've got the two speeds and then a park function. So you have to make sure that the wiper motor is then going to work with the PDM and stuff like that.
Right, right. I mean, I'll save you the trouble there. It hasn't got a screen. Okay. It's got an aero screen. So, yeah, so it's much the same as there's a case room right next to us. He probably out of shot again. I can't remember. But yeah, again, same deal as that, really.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to like explain like the whole process, but it's sort of, once you've sort of figured out what sort of route you're going down with the electronics, you sort of then we have to sit down and
assume make the assumption, because what I want to do is utilize that. There's like a theory that I've had with this, which is, imagine Porsche, it's like a 1950s race car basically, but there's like the design team of Porsche went, let's have some fun. What would we do with that now if we were going to start from scratch and build this from scratch? Well, they wouldn't be using relays and fuses in boxes and stuff. They'd be starting from scratch with PDMs and everything else, right?
Yeah, so I guess it depends on what sort of, whether you're trying to keep it a retro or whether you're trying to
Look retro, mega modern.
Yeah, everything. So you're going to want a PDM, you're going to want a decent ECU.
Yeah.
Is it air cooled, so it's carb?
It'll be
air cooled.
Yeah, it'll be carb. Again, so there's a company called Rightune, right? And they're going to be the guys that are going to be working on the engine design. So, and I, in much the same boat as I'm talking to you, kind of for the first time and figuring some of this stuff out, I need to go and have that conversation and sit down with them and figure out, well, what can you do? Because what's the theory that's being bounced around at the moment that no one's yet tried, that, you know, like all of that stuff? You see, because people, again, I think we're in it, and you can correct me on this, but I think we're in a situation now where people are going back to old engine design and seeing what you can do to kind of impart like the most modern thinking to that design to maximize the, you know, the performance and the kind of reliability aspect of it. Because back in the day, tuning a set of carbs, you know, all right, it was fine for the 50s and 60s and 70s, but you wouldn't opt for that now. It's just so flaky.
And like, there's a lot of companies now that are doing carbs that look like carbs, but they've also got
Gemby do that, right?
They've got electronic fuel injection built into the carb, but you'd never think it because the injectors are all hidden and stuff.
So it might be something like that. Yeah. You know, there's a company called Rensport, and they are like godlike air cool builds, and I've been talking to them on and off for ages, and they'll help me and they'll inform, and I know that they will support the build and stuff for that sort of thing. So to answer your question, it's going to be it's tricky, but just I guess without knowing the full requirements set at the moment and the build exactly, it's going to be like as modern as we can reasonably get. When you get to the point of starting to talk about a budget, this is I guess probably the tricky bit.
That's the next question as well.
It's the next question, right? Is what's the budget? Well, I don't want the budget, I don't want the build to be constrained. The quality comes first, right?
Yeah.
The output of the build has to be I'm going to shoot for Singer, right? So like panel, even though it's, you know, it's not a race car, it's a road car, but it's not going to be a quarter of a million quid road car, but I want the panel gaps to be like a quarter of a million quid road car. And I want the kind of, the wiring to be like, even when you look at it, you're like, no, I nailed that.
Yeah.
I nailed it.
Yeah.
Anyone can come out and look at this. I'm happy with that. Yeah. Like, and I want everybody that's involved to kind of be able to step back and go,
that was good. I like that. Yeah.
We, you know, it's a one of one build. We're not going to be turning these out, loads and loads of them. So, you know, now we were gotten get to the point where we were starting to talk about ECU selection, right? So there's obviously scales to this. There's going to be your budget. And I don't even know if this exists anywhere anymore. The last time I was looking at anything to do with ECUs, Mega Squirt, that kind of really bog standard, like probably early 2000s, stuff in a box, no one knows what it does, might make something work, might not.
That's generally the Mega Squirt stuff is pretty homemade.
Like, exactly. And then you've got all the way up to, you know, like Motec, which generally people know as
pretty high end.
Pretty high end, now, like I said before, I don't want to be constrained by budget, but I also...
At
some point, it's got to be reasonable, right? Yeah. I couldn't spend 100,000 quid on...
The electronics alone?
Couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to kill it.
Which
so
you could. Funnily enough, you actually can.
Spend that much money. Yeah.
It's crazy what some company or some high-end motorsport stuff is actually like
mega
what they're selling
expensive.
It for, yeah.
Yeah. And that, again, you know what? Like, I'm not saying that that's not...
It's not a
value.
Bad thing. Yeah.
It's just, again, there's...
There's levels to
there's
these
levels,
things.
There's levels, yeah, right. It's what can I achieve that gets the job done to a high standard that the right thing's been selected for the purpose, you know?
Yeah.
The actual tagline for engineering is design for purpose. It's like, pick what you're going to do with that thing, whatever it is, and then focus all your work on around, like, supporting it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's almost like saying, going back to a conversation I had with Barnsport Porsche about suspension, people putting... three-way adjustable coilovers on a car that they're never going to take on track, you know, it just or rose jointing absolutely everything and it being like
so then just go and drive the
to drive some B-roads or, you know, go up and down Queen's Road in London or King's Road in London. It's just a bit pointless, so, you know, that logic has to play into this as well, right? So
pretty much, yeah. And it generally, most of the time, it will do. It's you generally got, like, especially with electronics at the minute, you've got a wide scope of every level you could imagine, every product you could imagine, and it's generally you've got to try and pick through what is out there to try and find what will actually work, and that's the biggest nightmare most of the time.
So what have we got then? What's the like, if we work through the variations?
I'll just say that ECU wise, tuning wise, generally you'll want to go to the tuner and get their recommendation on what they're comfortable with, working with, because at the end of the day, they're going to be doing the setup
on it.
Dozens
of hours on it. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, but generally, I say pick your tuner, find what they're comfortable with, get their recommendation on the ECU, and then come back to me.
Fine.
So, I can give you the
let's get your take on it, because like noted, right? 100% noted.
Yeah.
That is that, you know, and that advice. And this is part of the reason why these conversations are so valuable, because I take this conversation as my reference point to then go away and do exactly what I've been advised, right? Someone in the you know, that's professionally doing this has said, go and speak to a tuner. And actually that's one thing I haven't done. I've got a couple of people I've spoken to, but I haven't got that far yet. I'll go and do it.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, and that's what you should do. You know, if you're building something, take advice from people that know what they're on about.
And
go on, sorry.
You also have to, like, sort of be wary that generally who you go and talk to, depending on who they are, is maybe trying to sell you something actually give you what you actually want.
Yeah.
So you've got to sort of be wary of who you're talking to and what you're trying to do.
I'd like to think my bullshitometer is quite well tuned.
Yeah.
And there's an element of due diligence for me that I've already kind of been either approached or spoke to a couple of companies where our values haven't aligned.
Mm.
They don't necessarily get what I'm trying to do, or they're just, you can tell there's a pitch involved.
Yeah.
For me, it's all about the relationships. You know, O Sport Design, very small company. You know, they're producing parts for Formula One, Tuthill, and, you know, loads of other companies, but they're still a tiny company yourself, small company. But you know the person you're working with then, right? And there's an element of trust that's built up between the two of you.
And you can build a relationship. And
for sure, right? So, but the, you know, the couple of the companies that I've spoken to where it's not going to go any further, it's been because it's just the wrong fit.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah. And that's, in business, that's 90% of what you're trying to do is you're just trying to build relationships.
Yeah.
That's the only way to get ahead.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So going back to the ECUs then. So again, noted about the kind of, like, go and speak to your tuner.
Yeah.
In your experience of working with, trying to build a harness around something.
Yeah.
Have you got any advice? Have you got any thoughts about kind of the selection criteria? Or because I would want to make sure that I don't turn up with someone and you go, oh dude, honestly, I can't be doing this again. We've been here before, not me, but you've been here before and it's a nightmare, right? That bit I want to avoid.
ECU wise, they're generally pretty good. Like
Each
company has got their own merits and they're generally okay. As long as you pick like some of the mainstream companies.
Fine.
Like if you got like the Mega Squirt route is probably
a bad idea.
Yeah, bad idea.
Let me be absolutely clear, that is not on the cards.
Yeah.
It was just a reference from back in the day.
Yeah. Like you have a lot of the older companies that are still around, but they're not as well used anymore. So you've got like the DTA and the Emerald that everybody
would have used because
back in the day. Yeah. But then they're still around but they're still used, but they're not as advanced or sort of, they're not as, they've not moved with the times.
They've probably got a cottage industry of their own that sustains them, right? And they don't need to invest, right? They're perfectly within their wheelhouse doing whatever they're doing, and more power to them for doing that. You know, if that's their business model and that's what they want to work to, great. That's not necessarily what I want to be. Like, I do want to push the envelope a little bit. So, and interestingly, I'm a big fan of Mighty Car Mods, and they, and for obvious reasons, they use a company that's right, and they just use the same company over and over and over again. Build up a relationship with that company, and it all makes sense, right? They know what you're trying to achieve. Yeah. So,
and so that company is sort of on the lower end, not
Haltech. We're talking about Haltech.
Yeah. So they're not on the lower end of the market, but they're sort of in that they've got their niche customer, or they've got their customer, which is your everyday project car customer.
Yeah.
That one product will do whatever they want it to do, which is totally fine.
Yeah.
That works for them. But then when you're getting into like a one-off build where you want to do certain things a certain way, or you've got something like the Porsche, for example, where it's a pretty high-end car with a modern ECU that can't be tuned easily, so that they end up with a solution from a higher end company like Cyvex, which then they gives them the full flexibility to be able to do whatever they want with it. So that's, it's generally, you've got to pick between what you're trying to achieve sort of thing, and then go from there. So like generally, if you want an ECU if you want an ECU that is going to do anything you want and give you that flexibility in the future to do anything you want, you generally want to start looking at the higher end stuff.
Right.
So you want to start looking at like Cyvex, Life, Motec generally. To be honest, there isn't many makes out there, like higher end wise.
Yeah.
A lot of the market is filled with the, I don't like saying lower end, but like.
No, the kind of club level stuff.
Yeah. So everyday stuff, I guess. So you've got like the Link, the Haltech, there's a couple of others, but in that general,
they're all
range,
in that bundle, right?
Yeah.
And it's, so what's the, how do you differ? Apologies if this is kind of breaching into the bit that it's like you need to be talking to an ECU company about this stuff.
Yeah.
It's fine, don't just tell me. What's the kind of, if you had the two in your hand, is there any fundamental, is it the flexibility of what you can do with it is the thing, or is the build quality different?
From my point of view, from a wiring point of view, it usually comes down to the input and output availability. So most of the stuff on the lower end has a limited input and output availability.
Fine.
So you generally end up with like 10 inputs and maybe 10 outputs on most of their range of ECUs. And then the more inputs and outputs you want, the higher the price goes.
It sounds like oscilloscopes are the same, right? You buy a scope and you get a two-channel scope for like 350 quid.
It'll do the job. Yeah.
But actually, if you want a scope that can do like CAN bus decoding and can go down to like ridiculous, you know, low voltage levels and things like that and be really sensitive, then you're paying for it.
Exactly. Same. Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah. Essentially, it's just a computer and you're paying for the processing ability of that computer. So the more inputs and outputs you're trying to give it, the more processing power it needs to be able to process all that stuff.
So this conversation is really useful, by the way. I'm getting something out of this. I hope you are too. It sounds to me like the development in terms of the engine choice, what potential the engine has to be developed and the sort of the way we could approach that will almost dictate, and plus the other stuff I want to do with it. Things like, if I wanted to put traction control in and that sort of stuff, then there's an element of that that's got to be factored in.
Yeah.
That would probably dictate the ins and outs, right? The amount of...
Yeah.
Right. So then I know what that looks like and I go, cool. I can potentially approach you or an ECU company or both and go...
To see which one fits.
This is what the plan is.
Do you have something that fits?
Yeah. Yeah. Where does that leave me? Fine.
The other thing you sort of have to be careful with is a lot of the companies out there, generally Haltech's pretty bad at this, or good or bad, depending on how you look at it. They have their own ecosystem.
Yeah.
So all their products work together and they work together beautifully.
It's the Apple of, yeah.
Yeah. And, but the minute you try to put an outside product in that system, then it becomes
it
a problem.
It shits the bed. Yeah.
Like, I guess it probably works, but it just takes a lot more time and effort to be able to make it work
and
or integrate it.
And then there's cost if there's time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And if you spent loads more time on it and it costs loads more money, you probably could have gone to a different solution in the first place.
Exactly.
It balanced out, isn't it? Yeah.
So like from when you look at it from like when you've got a PDU and an ECU, you've got to look at it to see how the relationship works between the two.
Yeah.
Because Life Racing and Cyvex are pretty good at this because they've got what they call a slave link between the ECU and the PDU if you go with both their systems. And then basically it means that the ECU and PDU are always talking to each other and they're always communicating all the data back and forth.
Yeah.
So that essentially it also gives you expansion for like you can use all the inputs and outputs on PDU for ECU stuff and vice versa.
Cool.
But again, that's you pay for that because they're a higher end brand.
Yeah.
But like then you get into like the, so like Haltech, for example, has their own ecosystem and it's all just done on CAN.
Right.
So you just plug everything in and it all comes up and works.
Can we do a 2 second, it's probably longer than 2 seconds, but and I've been talked about this before. So one of the listeners to the podcast spoke to me and said, I don't understand some of the technical stuff. It's like, well, right. And I'm not going to do it because I'm a novice as well. Can you give me 1 minute on CAN?
CAN is controller area network. So it's essentially just two wires that send messages back and forth between two devices all the time. So instead of having, let's say, a whole bunch of inputs into your ECU, you can have like a device in the back of the car with the inputs being inputted. And then rather than running a whole bunch of wires to the other side of the car, you can then send two wires from one device to the other, and it will then send all the information from that one device to the other, rather than hardwiring everything and having
and
everything
on,
as an individual.
Like, time slots, effectively. So it's sliced into your, I'm trying to remember some theory here and I'm going to not get it right.
Yeah.
But imagine you've got like a pulse basically, and you fill that space, that time, with information, and then there's more information on the next piece of time.
And
then that's how it flows through that wire.
I only have a basic understanding of it because I do a little bit of it, but not a huge amount.
Yeah.
But essentially, it's a whole bunch of different like bytes of information that are sent at a different time, and then they're encoded, and one device encodes them, and then the other decodes them, and has to read, then knows what it's being sent.
Yeah. There you go. I hope that if you don't ever know what CAN is, then that's probably given you a very basic understanding.
It's used a lot more than people think. Like it's used in pretty much every modern car. There's probably about 5 or 6 different CAN buses running.
Which is good and bad, right? Because if you want to do anything additional to that car, it's quite easy to cock it up.
Yeah.
And if, you know, whereas back in the day you wanted to, you know, it was just very basic.
You just hardwire an input and you're good to go. Yeah. Whereas now it's more of a programming thing.
Yeah.
You sort of have to know what you're looking for and how it's coded to then decode it, to then send your own message on the bus to then make sure it all works. Sort of like, so a lot of the OEM CAN bus, like that's sort of that Porsche sort of stuff.
Mm.
I'd imagine it's none of the information is out there, so
it's proprietary.
Yeah. So you have to then, so like to put a Cyvex on that, the people when they were doing the original development would have had to spend like days and all weeks just decoding CAN bus to make sure everything works properly.
I mean, fair play to doing it right. And that's a blank checkbook build, clearly,
pretty much. But it's one of those things, companies spend tons of money on development just to make a product, don't they, and they just write it off as R&D.
Amazing. I think the best thing to do now, if it's all right with you, is we'll go move into the wiring shop, which is just behind us. And then we'll start taking a look at some examples of the work and what, and you can talk me through it if that's all right with you. Mega, cool. Let's have a look. Let's do that. So this, like, tell me, so I can see ECU written down there.
So that's essentially like the really rough first draft of what I'll do to make, to see if it's all going to work. So I'll sort of get an idea in my head, measure it out in the car, then draw it out. And then we'll go sit at the computer for a couple of hours and do a digital copy of it. And then do a full pin out, pin to pin diagram. So that we know exactly where everything's going and how it's going to be and any details that are then detailed on the pin out document.
This is mad. So this is where we get into the mad scientist stuff, because it just looks like a big ass spreadsheet that I wouldn't have a bloody clue about. So
it's essentially that. That's all it is. It's essentially, it's a pin-to-pin document that that tells you this pin, then goes to this pin, and it's got this color ident on it.
Oh, okay. There's some logic there. It's like, it looks like a...
But as a customer, that's what I would send you if you were then, if you wanted to do any fault findings, you could pin-to-pin. But from my point of view, it's there. It's a build sheet as well, because it's also got all the information, like all the connectors, all the terminals we use, what crimp tool is needed for that terminal, the length of the wire, where it's located, and the twist and stuff like that.
So tools, then, you mentioned about tools, special to type. It's going to be like, these are things that you purchase to do probably a single job, and you get that for engines and all that sort of stuff as well. But actually, if we can grab a second just to take a look at the types of tools that you might use. So
I don't know. Just to interrupt, but I don't know whether you want to show that, like, that's just one harness, and then there's a full car.
Okay.
So essentially that's one page that's just one part of the harness, and then each individual page is another part of the harness. So this car's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different harnesses.
Madness. I don't ever want to hear anybody moan about paying for this stuff, because it's the amount of time it must take to go through that painstakingly.
Well, a full car to produce a pinout document, and a lot of the time it's not cost effective to do digital drawings, like a copy of that. I'll just do a quick rough version of that, so I've got a digital copy, so if that gets destroyed. But it's generally about a day, 2 days to do a full car. Just to do this.
Just to do that.
Yeah.
Madness. Right.
But if they want like actual physical drawings, like a CAD drawing or whatever, it takes even longer.
Really?
So that's why it's not
So that's part of the customer journey, right? Is to kind of talk to them about what you need.
Well, it's sort of like, from your point of view, that's where we would have to sort of do that thing where we'd have to do the CAD drawings, because you obviously haven't got a... You're probably at a design stage, so you need to know how things are going to look and how they're going to work and how they're going to fit. So you essentially, all your stuff is going to be done in CAD anyway at the beginning.
Yeah.
So that's the type of project or customer that we do the drawings for. But anything that we've got in front of us that sort of has our general lead time for a full car start to finish is like 4 to 6, maybe 8 weeks if it's a big build. So generally, if we want to get it done in that time frame, we can't generally do a lot of things that we would if it was a long-term project. It's not so much cutting corners, it's just you've got to be efficient, and there's certain things just aren't efficient.
Definitely. Right, so lots of pages of lots of diagrams, lots of pinouts, you got some hand-drawn stuff to be cost effective for the customer. You can do the full CAD stuff if you have to.
Yeah.
But again, it's for the needs of the customer and the use case, I guess, and whether it's going to be a repeated build or it's like a one-off.
Yeah. Generally, if it's a production type thing, we'll do a full CAD full thing. Drawing,
yeah. Yeah. Wicked. Okay. So tools. Let's have a look at tools then, mate. Talk me through some of this stuff that we've got then.
Well, a lot of the, so it depends, it's depending on what sort of connector and what sort of thing you're working with. So generally, like any of the motorsport, auto sport connectors, so like those circular ones, you'll generally need the specialist expensive tooling, which is these ones. And then, so this is the frame, and then you've got each individual die, depending on what terminal, what size terminal, what different variant of terminal you're using, which then you just insert, and it gives you the specs on it for what wire size you're using with the contact. So then you can set the tension for the crimp tension. And then essentially it's just, other than that, it's just wire stripping tools. We've got, they have like, rather than just like the normal automotive strippers, these are got special dies in them for the actual wire we're using. So they're specific for the wire rather than like that would be a conventional automotive stripper.
That's the sort of thing I've used loads of times in the past.
So whereas this one's like made for each individual wire size and the die is specific for the wire we use. To get to make sure that it never damages the internal conductor and it only strips off the actual insulation. And then like you've got, so then the next thing would be, you've got like the, these are just crimp tools for like any, like the OEM connectors or like the general normal connectors. So anything with like an open barrel or anything like that. And then it's just
variations.
There's a wide variety because there's so many different terminals, contacts and stuff like that.
Yeah, of course.
You've got some of the, like the, that's more of a, that's like a universal kit. And then you've got like the specific die sets for specific terminals with each wire size. So they're all automatic crimpers.
Amazing. And then, so don't ever stick your finger in one of these things, because like, I mean, you can't because it's tiny, but like people don't know, do they? Once you start with that thing, you've got to go all the way to the end to back it off. You can't kind of just...
So like these ones are all locking. So once you've started...
You are in,
you can't unlock it.
Yeah.
So like I've done it before where you put the terminal in and it twists because it's like in there wrong a little bit and you crimp it and it's just screwed it up.
Cool. Mega. So that's tools. That's the tools. That's the kind of the initial drawings. That's getting it into either CAD if you need that, or your pinout spreadsheets. Got all of that. And then we're starting to start what? Like you've got you know exactly how it's going to go in. You've looked at the car. You've figured it all out.
So once we've done all the design and the planning and documentation, we'll start by project where we've essentially terminated each individual connector. Because obviously we've worked out how we're going to start the harness.
Yeah.
And then the starting point is these three are the ECU connector. So our start point is the ECU.
Yeah.
So we'll then start from there. So then we'll pin out each plug and then do a... So then we because most of the wire colors are the same, we only use a variation of different wire colors depending on what it is. So like most of them are all white, we'll use idents.
Yeah.
So the idents will then refer back to our pinout to tell you what it does. It's a lot of, I guess you'd call it the preparation stage before you actually start like constructing a harness.
Yeah. So those, just talk to me about these idents, mate. Are they, from what I've used in the past, I don't know if it's the same, but they're like heat shrink idents. So you just slide them on and they're basically free to actually go on the wire, and then you just get a heat gun, quickly blast over the heat gun, and it shrinks onto the wire, so you've got your wiring done.
That's it, essentially.
And that refers back to your spreadsheet and all that, they all match, right? That's your,
That's exactly how it works, because a lot of the time, each individual wire color, from a price standpoint, it's not cost effective to have every color wire in stock.
Yeah.
To do something different with every color.
Yeah.
So it's easier and more cost effective to just do everything in a certain amount of colors and then ident them. So the idents then refer back to what the actual function of the wire is, depending on what you've signed it to on the pinout.
The only time that's a ball ache as a customer is when you've got a problem halfway through, and then you've got to start, you've got to figure out, and you've got a big old wiring bundle in the middle, and you're like,
yeah,
they're all white.
Yeah. So from a customer point of view, theoretically, you would never see inside the harness.
Yeah.
You would only ever see pin to pin. So yeah, that's okay. Why the wire color generally doesn't matter because the harness, especially, well, in what I do anyway, the harness is always fully sealed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you'll only ever see pin to pin, and that's why
why you go back to that.
Yeah, that's why we do pin to pin rather than like a normal automotive harness. 9 times out of 10, you can open it up and you can find the wire color and you just trace it back.
Yeah.
Whereas this harness, if you do that, the whole harness is destroyed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You lose the full integrity of the
harness. So theoretically, the wire color and the idents are only for a construction purpose. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's it.
And for me, really, and then once you've got the harness and it's on the car and you have a fault or a problem, you'll then, for testing, you'll go pin to pin.
Yeah. And by pin to pin, we're talking continuity test between one end to the other.
Yeah.
So you just basically run a very low level voltage from one end, and if it beeps on the other end, you know, you've got a good wire.
Theoretically, yes, but there's cases where it'll still do that, but it won't be a good wire.
Fine.
So that's where you then need to do a load test to make sure the wire is still fully intact.
Yeah, cool. Mega, so this is the starting point.
Yeah, so that's one of the AutoSwap connectors for the specialist tool in that.
Yes,
It's quite expensive.
cool.
Yeah, once we've done this, we'll then start constructing the harness pretty much. You'll do all the service loops first.
Right.
So you'll at this end of the connector, you'll like sort of loop the wire, give it a little loop at the beginning.
Yes.
So just so that essentially
this is a tension relieving process, right?
Yes. It's,
so if there's, there's any flex in the actual connector as it's going in, it's not putting either constriction on the internal or overbearing on the outside.
It. So there's two reasons really. So you've got the strain relief reason. There's always a little bit of movement, so that if the harness moves or whatever, there's some
attention's not placed on the if it's a solder or if you're bucket filled and you like if it's into a solder joint, all that tension goes into the solder joint, which is not what you want. If it's a mechanical joint, you still don't want tension on the mechanical joint.
Exactly.
You want it on the flex.
Yeah, so you give it a little bit of a loop to just give it a bit of strain relief. So when you pull it, it pulls the loop rather than the wire. Yeah. But the other reason is, God forbid, if there's ever needed to be a repair or a change, you can then get into it and you've got that extra bit of wire to play with rather than
not what you want, but it's there. Another way, because otherwise you've got to deep in the entire plug,
yeah,
and then you either shorten the wire, but then you might not have enough on the other side to be able to pull it through slightly further. So it's you're in big problem territory at that point.
Yeah, so that's why that's why they call it a service loop, is if you have to service something or change or whatever, you can just pull it out and you've got that extra bit of wire.
Service loop.
I should preface it by saying that 9 times out of 10, you should only do it if you're booting the connector.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So if you have a connector where there's no boot on it, you can do it, but it doesn't look as tidy and it's not ideal.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So you got your, to this stage. To try not to lose the entire audience at this point, because we are full into nerdy territory.
So after this, once we've done this, we would then get into the harness construction, which would then involve the wiring layup.
You're talking about the way you lay out the wiring actually. And this has got like a twist that runs across the whole thing, right? Yep.
So that specific way it's done is called concentric twisting.
Concentric twisting.
So essentially you have, I'm not sure if you can see, but there's a inner layer of this one in particular has got an inner layer of two wires.
Yeah.
And then it's got another layer of, I think eight or nine. And then the next layer is then, 12 or 16, I think something like that.
Yeah.
Which then fills up the hole, gives you a concentrically wound harness, which is then perfectly circular all the way through.
Amazing. Rad.
So
love
essentially,
it.
The other advantage of it is that on a normal automotive harness, a big bundle of wires is quite thick.
Yeah.
Because you bundle them all together and you just hope that they all sit together
nicely.
Whereas this, you organize all the wires and you actually end up with a smaller overall diameter for more wires.
Yeah.
So this is essentially, I think, 26, 27 wires.
Right.
And if you bundle it, you'd end up with a OD of, I don't know, I can't remember what that is, but you'd end up with a slightly bigger OD.
It's like a 7mm OD, isn't it? Or something like that.
Whereas that's probably like a 5mm OD.
Wicked.
The
outer diameter, by the way, if anyone missed what OD was.
Yeah. There's also the other advantage, I guess you would say, is because these are all quite small wires, you kind of have to be wary of what you're doing with them.
Yeah, sure.
So if you run them in a straight bundle and then you bend it, the one on the inside or the outside is always going to be shorter or longer.
Yeah.
So you're always going to have tension on one of the wires somewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas this, the way it's wound, all the wires are the same length.
Right.
So you can essentially just do like that.
Wild, isn't it? Because it, like, again,
and it's never strained.
No, because, and this is going back to what I was saying a few minutes ago, is that typically if you're working on any wiring, there is a bend radius that it's like a minimum bend radius for this stuff, because not for this, I've just been taught why that's the case, but certainly in what I've been taught before is like, be really careful of that stuff, because it can, you know, you can have this perfect build, it looks beautiful, and then you've got this one thing you've kinked and it's really tight and it's just scrap, like you're just gonna get instant faults.
So at the end of the day, the copper inside of it is a metal. You kink it, it's gonna snap eventually.
And even if you don't snap the entire thing, depends on how many strands you've got in that.
Breaking one strand to cause a problem.
Yeah, definitely. So next step, what's the next stage, if we're going to call them stages then? So we've got early stuff, we've got kind of sections, and then we're at what, this? So let's just bring the camera around and grab a bit of this.
We'd sort of get to this sort of stage where the harness is...
I'm just trying to think of the best shot, really. I'll tell you what, mate, if you talk from it from there, move it slightly closer, but I'll just edit all the shit out. And then we can, because it's good. The bit that I want to make sure of is that the viewer gets like us and the bit of equipment in shot. So where are we now then, mate?
That's a harness that's then fully laid out. That's a small one, obviously, which is then, it's now ready to be terminated to its final connectors. So all the connectors on the end, it's fully labeled up with what each function is like. So that's like for the fuel pump.
Yeah.
And then obviously we'll put the ring terminals on there. And then there's obviously a label on it for what that harness is and the part number or the serial number that it equates to, which then again goes back to the pinout drawing so you can find it.
Madness. And the bit that I'm struggling with here is that, going back to, I'm going to flatter you, don't get too embarrassed, but you talked it down, like the level of knowledge and skill and learning, that you don't walk in one day and be like, I know how to do this now. It must have taken you hours and hours and hours of, like, you must have had to spend a long time figuring this stuff out to get to a standard where you talking about it so easily to me. Yeah.
Well, I guess it's been my life for the last, like, as a business, I've been going for 3 years, but I was doing it for at least a year, 2 years before that.
Mm.
So I've pretty much lived this 100% or 110% without doing anything else for 5 years, I guess. So I didn't come through anything for like motorsport. So if you wanted to do this in like one of the bigger companies, you would go to college and or university and do motorsport engineering, get into electronics, get an apprenticeship with one of the bigger companies, then go through their department.
Yeah.
Whereas I've sort of just come from nowhere, or come from like a non-automotive car.
I love it. I think it's brilliant.
I saw it online and I was just like,
yeah, man,
I want to do that.
And I hope that comes across actually as well, is if there's something that you want to do, you know, don't be deterred from the routes that are available to you. Certainly I've spoken to people that are doing some stuff that they say they're not trained, or, you know, I talked about imposter syndrome a few minutes ago. Bullshit. Honestly, just having a go to a certain extent, yes, obviously it doesn't get you to a really high standard, but it gets you to the point where, you know, you're actively interested in something and you're spending time doing it. So, and then there's obviously the gap between turning that from like an enthusiast or an interest into something that you can then sell and monetize, and then that's your job. And then that takes the dedication and your 10,000 hours. But yeah, don't be put off. If there's something, if you're watching this and you're like, oh, I want to change career, just have a go. Just get stuck in and just do the research and put the time in.
Yep, cool. That's all you need.
So that's your wiring harness. The battery terminated, but everything else is good to go.
So then that'll all be terminated. That'll then be tested and then it'll be sealed up.
Yeah.
So then it'll be like, so we'll use epoxy resin, put the final boots on, shrink them down. It's all sealed up then it's all weather tight.
Amazing. So this is, you're just saying off camera, an OEM harness, right?
Yeah, essentially, this is going to be just an OEM replacement harness for like a EP3 Type R or someone that's having like a K20 swapped, anything really. We're using like the standard ECU, but it's more of like it's just a higher end version of the OEM harness, really. So essentially, it's a bit different in the fact that not everything is sealed and booted, but everything's been taken care of as like, the end of the harness is still sealed with a piece of heat shrink, like glue lined heat shrink. And then the seals have been specifically sized to meet the wire size.
Yeah.
So that it is still waterproof, but it's not a fully sealed booted harness.
Yeah. But again, as we were talking before about the needs of the customer, if this was in a road car or a light track car, you don't need to go to the extent of it being all, you know,
that's essentially what this is. I think it's going in a track car.
It's just a
high quality, reliable upgrade over the stock engine harness, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, awesome.
So it still uses all like the stock connectors, the same stock injectors, stock coils, stuff like that.
Perfect, cool.
But you can still see that each transition point is still sealed with epoxy.
Yeah.
That still retains the sealed integrity of the harness effectively, because the harness itself is still sealed because you're sealing it here and at the end.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, that makes sense.
But you've just got these little bits of exposed
wire
effectively.
It's beautiful as well. It depends on what your version of beautiful is, but I think it's really nice to look at. Really cool.
I think that's why my Instagram's a little bit like, it's got popular, because it's just not the stuff that I post is like nice to look at. It's pleasing.
Amazing. Cool. I hope you've really enjoyed this episode. For me, it's been fascinating, both from the kind of REN 550 and understanding what I need to do, what my next steps are in terms of figuring out how I can come back to Matt with something that is, you know, more logical as, you know, what we can do next. I hope you've enjoyed I hope it's been a learning experience for you in this as well, that actually if you're a wiring expert, then I hope you've got something out of it. If you're really new to this stuff and actually your experience is, you know, either nothing or low level, that you might have, you know, got some takeaways. If you haven't already, follow the YouTube channel at Rengineering, on Facebook, not Twitter, because I hate Twitter, or X, whatever it's called, I don't know. And it's at Rengineering UK on Instagram. But otherwise, make sure you follow. And all podcast streaming services. If you want to listen to the audio version of this, it's on all podcast streaming services. For now, though, thank you so much, Matt.
No problem.
Enjoy this time. Thank you so much.
No problem.
And if you've got any questions for Matt, what's your Instagram, dude?
My Instagram's LevelMSW. I'm pretty sure it's the same on most of the social medias.
Yeah.
And the website's levelmotorsportwiring.co.uk.
There you go. And I'll see you back another time. Thanks so much for watching, and take care for now. Bye.
Bye.
Well, whether you stay for the start and then binned it off, and then fast forwarded it to the end of the episode, or you've sat through the whole thing, including some of the stuff, which is obviously, you know, a video of, you know, a lot of it. I chose to kind of leave some of the things that are more video oriented. Still within the podcast as well, because there's useful bits in there as well. So thank you for sticking with it. I hope you learned something, actually. Pop in the comments section of Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to this, if you've got any questions of Matt from Level, or if it's for me particularly, we'll respond to those. Do hope you've got a lovely bank holiday weekend planned, if you are lucky enough to have a bank holiday this weekend. I'm about to go and shut all this down. I'll upload this on and get it distributed for everybody to listen to, and then I'm going to relax and enjoy listening to lots of live music for the weekend. And I will see you Monday at the Legends Drivers Club event, Sonderwunsch at Goodwood. And if not there, then I'll see you on the 20th of September at Box and Gas for the Niners Live episode. There will be another episode next week. There's two more that I'm going to put out, and then I'll take a break because I want to switch to really heavily working on the kind of the build series for my car and get that out, because I'm really focused and conscious of some of that stuff. It's really important to get it out. One of the other tech talks that will come out as well, which is the Gold Leaf Performance tech talk, so learning about the background. Again, it's the interior and the GT4 RS side intakes, the kind of the real feature points of my Rengineering Cayman. So and there's, we've already shot when I was at the Nürburgring last year, a really cool deep dive into their back history and how they got to where they are, and all about their GT4 RS intake as well. So if you've got a Cayman you're thinking about, and it doesn't matter if it's a 718 or a 981, you've been thinking about that, but you want to learn a bit more about those guys and how they got to where they are and the quality and all that stuff, then that's coming as well. So stick with it for that. There's a couple of episodes that are going to be heritage based episodes with big Porsche brands in the UK as well, so sit tight for those. They're coming up in the next couple of weeks. For now though, I'm gonna head off. I'm amazed Mochi hasn't barked at all through this entire intro or outro, but there you go, I'm sure he will at some point. Do take care of yourselves and go and enjoy the sun, and if you're anywhere else in the world, and then deep dive and buy yourself a copy of 911 and Porsche World and have a read about what they thought about my car, and I'll speak to you soon. Take care for now. Bye bye.